People in the first century saw the world differently than we see it. To those who first heard our gospel story, or to those who were there when it was taking place, there was no trying to discern what really happened. There was no questioning if the man had epilepsy or a mental illness. There was no trying to figure it out and diagnose what was wrong with him. There was no questioning. They believed that demons could possess a person. They knew a person could be filled with an unclean spirit, and they were certain that a miracle of healing was truly possible for someone who was possessed in that way. So, if we're going to grasp the meaning of this story, it probably is more helpful to put ourselves in that mindset than to keep the one that we have. And so to imagine the world the way that they saw it, that yes, there are demons, and yes, they do possess people, and yes, a miracle can save them. So the question then is not, did it happen, or how did it happen? For those who were present and for those who first heard the story, the important question was who? Who was the man possessed? And more importantly, who was Jesus? To start, the man, known only as the Gerasene demoniac, probably wasn't Jewish. This story is the only time in Luke's gospel where he reports that Jesus left the territory of the Jews and went into the territory of the Gentiles. The area of Gerasene is to the east of the Sea of Galilee, and so they've come across the lake and they are in unfamiliar territory. And of course, this explains then why there were so many pigs there, because if it had been a Jewish community, there wouldn't be a whole lot of pigs. But for the Gentiles, this was a cheap source of protein. For the Romans who occupied that area, you know, they could make bacon and they could make ham and sausage, and the food would last, and they could take it from place to place. So we know where the man lived. We know who he wasn't. He wasn't a Jew. But we don't know a whole lot else about him. He's not even given the dignity of being referred to as the Gerasene man who was possessed by demons. He was the demoniac. He is defined by his trauma and by little else. His hometown people tried to bring his wildness under control by binding him with chains, but he couldn't be contained. The only place that would take him, the only place he was welcome, was the cemetery, which was outside of the city walls and was out where the wild animals would hunt and look for strays. It was not a place where you would like to live. If Jesus had asked their advice, the neighbors would have told him that the man was dangerous. Stay away, they would have said. But Jesus didn't ask their advice. Instead, Jesus went where he was needed, and nobody needed him more than this man. This poor, naked, lonely, wild man. When Jesus asked the man's name, it was the demons who replied. They said, "Legion, for we are many." For people in the ancient Roman world, legion had only one meaning. It was a unit of approximately 6,000 Roman soldiers. They were the occupying army. They were the enemy. They represented overwhelming power that nobody could resist. Their presence was a constant source of cruelty and terror for the people who lived in that area. A Roman soldier who was tired of carrying his pack could take someone along the wayside and just force them into carrying his stuff for a mile. That was the law. Just grab you by the scruff of the neck and say, "Here, I don't want to carry this, you do it for a mile." Roman tax collectors took the people's money, and as we've heard in stories, they were great cheats. And they spent the money on foolish entertainments. And of course, the Romans were famous for their willingness to have capital punishment. They crucified those who broke their laws, and the roads up and down their territory were littered with crosses, which they would recycle again and again and again. It was a sign to the people, keep yourselves in line, because if not, this is where you could end up. By calling themselves legion, the demons told Jesus that they were more than just a collection of bad spirits. They were powerful. They were cruel. They ruled this man, and they ruined his life. And yet, As powerful as they were, the demons knew that they were no match for Jesus. And when they looked at Jesus, they saw God's power at work, and they could see what was coming next. And so they pled with Jesus not to send them back to the abyss, but instead they said, please send us into that herd of pigs. And Jesus allowed it, cared more about the demons than the pigs, which is sort of curious, but he was a good Jewish boy. God only knows why the pigs rushed headlong into the sea to drown themselves. Perhaps the legion was too much even for them to bear. The man who was possessed put on clothing. He calmly sat at Jesus' feet, and he began living his life again. Stories like this cannot help but make me wonder. And I believe in the Bible, and I believe that Jesus did incredible, powerful things. But I always, when I read these stories, ask myself, are there really demons at work in the world? Are there really people who are in need of exorcisms? I grew up when The Exorcist was the hot book to read on the bus to junior high, and then that movie came out with a girl whose head spinned around in circles and she got sick with, oh, it was terrible. Didn't ever want to watch that movie all the way through, but I thought exorcisms and exorcists, that must be something from way gone by. They don't have that in the Lutheran church. Does it really exist? Or is this just a legendary story with only pieces of truth interwoven in it? Whatever happened that day, we know that Jesus was behind the changes that occurred. And this story tells us that evil is present and that is real and it is in our world. But it also says that God has the power to overcome that evil. There are times when the only explanation for some horrific event is that evil has been at work. It is scary, and it is frustrating. We want to reach out, and we want to help those wild, self-destructive people. We want to help free them from the demons that are hurting them. We want to help them find a normal life. We want a miracle to fix what is broken inside of them. And we'd like to fix it right now, and preferably we'd like to fix it before they hurt someone else. But it seldom happens that easily or all that quickly. And if we're really honest with ourselves, then we must admit that the forces of good and evil, the forces of God and evil, are at work in us as well. St. Paul said, I can will what is right, but I cannot do it. For I do not do the good I want, but the evil I do not want is what I do. We all have those days, the struggle of good and evil between us. In a rather more dramatic way. In the early 1960s, Adolf Eichmann was captured and tried for his part in engineering the Holocaust. He was one of those really scary bad men. He was responsible for facilitating and managing the logistics of mass deportation to ghettos and to extermination camps in Nazi-occupied Europe. At the end of his trial, he was found guilty of crimes against humanity. One of the most dramatic moments in the trial occurred when Yehiel Diener, who was a Holocaust survivor, entered the courtroom to testify against Eichmann, who had condemned him to a concentration camp many, many years before. When he walked into the courtroom, Diener stopped suddenly, and then he began to sob uncontrollably, and then he fainted. Later, in a 60 Minutes interview with Mike Wallace, Diener explained what had happened. He had seen Eichmann sitting there in the courtroom, and he had been overwhelmed at the sight. It wasn't that he had been suddenly overcome by fear or hatred. Instead, he was startled to see that Eichmann was not this godlike, all-powerful Nazi officer who he remembered. The man who, with a wave of his hand, could save you or sentence you to death, he didn't see that. Instead, the Eichmann in that courtroom was just an ordinary-looking, tired old man. Diener said, I was afraid about myself. I saw that I am capable to do this. I am exactly like he is. Alexander Solzhenitsyn, who survived the Soviet gulags to win a Nobel Prize, put it like this. He said, the line dividing good and evil cuts through the heart of every human being. So we all need saving. And Jesus came to save us, just as he saved that wild man of Gerasa. Jesus saves us in 1,000 different ways. And that's the answer to the riddle of this story. If you want to know who Jesus is, you look at this story and it's clear he is and was and will be the one who saves us. He is the Savior. No matter how overwhelming the circumstances, he has the power to save us. I don't know about you, but every so often someone will ask me when I was saved or have I been saved? And they're really asking me, when was it that I sort of came to myself and realized that I really did believe in Jesus, and when did I come to my pastor and say, please, I want to be baptized? Well, I was a Lutheran kid. I was baptized when I was 3 months old. I don't remember it at all. And I haven't had a dramatic conversion event that I could say to someone and say, here, let me tell you about my story. This fabulous thing happened. And that's when I knew that God was real and Jesus loved me and I'd been saved. My story is more about 1,000 little things that have happened over the years, maybe 10,000 little things. It has happened when I've heard a good word from the pulpit, or there was a moment of wonder in a Sunday school class. I felt it in the community of the church camp where I worked. And on more than one occasion, the light has suddenly come on as I'm driving my car from one place to the other. At times, I have envied other people's dramatic experiences, their sense of conversion, where everything in their life changed, and they can say, this is the moment. I can tell you the date. I can even tell you the time. But I also think it's better to be saved by a lighthouse than by a lifeboat. It's better to be saved before the wreck than after it's over. I have known other people who were saved after the wreck. They were in their lifeboat and somebody came and God saved them, and they are grateful as well. Maybe even more grateful than I am, because they know what it is like to live crazily among the tombs, to be cut off from normal life, to be truly miserable. They know what that is. And they are grateful for what Jesus has done for them. Grateful to be saved, grateful for their new lives, and most of them will tell their stories gladly, and their stories are always good ones to hear. The man whom Jesus healed wanted to go with him. He wanted to leave his hometown to follow Jesus wherever it was that he would go. But Jesus, who had called lots of other people to come and follow him, says to this guy, no, you stay here. Don't follow me. Go home. Tell the people how much God has done for you. Don't hold back. Preach it out loud. Go and tell them. And the man did just that. He became a missionary to his hometown, telling them what Jesus had done for them, which must have been a powerful witness. They knew this man. They had seen him, and now he was well. He was whole. He'd been saved. Now, it's pretty easy to give little or no attention to a preacher's sermon. People sometimes actually nod off when these things are happening. It is easy to just say, well, I'll read that Bible story later. But you can't ignore a person like that who has life has been completely changed. Every time that man's neighbors saw him, they remembered who he had been and they remembered Jesus. At first reading, our gospel for today may seem like a simple healing story, but it isn't. It is so much more. Christ wants to save us, and then he wants us to tell other people what he has done, to show people what has happened to our lives. He wants us to become living, breathing witnesses to all of his saving power. Scottish preacher Robert Menzies said, "We are saved by Christ to be saviors of others." Every person in this congregation can be a hometown missionary for Christ. If you have a story to tell, if you feel that God has saved you, that God has made a difference in your life, you can share that story with other people. This week, we were just sort of shooting the breeze, as the staff might do, and Susan told me about her great niece, Anna Beer. A lot of you know Anna. She's 5 or 6 now. She's 5. This week, Anna was telling people about Vacation Bible School, that she was going to jam camp, and then her grandma will tell you she was collecting change, because tomorrow we're collecting pennies, and the next day nickels, and then dimes, and quarters, and then we're hoping for some paper money, because we're going to buy some shoes for kids who don't have shoes. Some shoes that actually grow from one size, five sizes, for little feet that grow so fast and don't have shoes. We're going to do that this week. And Anna was telling people about it, grown-up people about it. She can do it, so can we. People ever ask you why you are the way you are, why you seem happy, what you do on Sundays, where have you been, what's going on with you? You have a story to tell. If you didn't, you wouldn't be here. You've got something to say. You have been saved to be a savior. And if Anna can do it at age 5, the rest of us surely must be able to do it as well. There's a song that says, I sing because I'm happy, I sing because I'm free. His eye is on the sparrow and I know he watches me. God is with you. You are a child of God. You have been saved, but not saved to sit on a shelf, but saved to do something, to be something, to share God's good news. Remember Anna this week. And if you have any spare change, we'd love to have it. We're buying shoes.